It's my pleasure to introduce the speaker. Unfortunately, our president, Janet Cole, had a slight illness, so we're hoping she's getting better quickly today. But I'm going to do the introduction in lieu of Janet. Our speaker today is Dr. Larry Smart, who is a professor in the horticulture section of the School of Integrative Plant Sciences at Cornell University and is an associate director of Cornell Agritech in Geneva. Larry is a plant geneticist and breeder whose lab uses genomic tools in breeding shrub willow bioenergy crops and to better understand vigor, hybrid vigor and pest and disease resistance. More recently, Larry has been leading Cornell's hemp research and extension team and has initiated a long-term breeding program to develop new hemp cultivars for New York State production. He received his B.S. in biology at Cornell University, Ph.D. In genetics at Michigan State University, and was I knew he was a pretty good guy, but got to plug MSU. He's an NSF postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis. So welcome, Larry. Oh, there you are.
Well, thanks very much, Carl. Thanks very much for the invitation to speak in this forum and to the other organizers, giving me a chance to present our work from the Cornell Hemp Team. I just want to emphasize here on the co-author list that we've only been working on hemp for about 2 years. We started at Cornell in mid-2016. I've only been working on hemp since April of 2017, so only a little more than 2 years. And here I am, I'm giving a keynote talk at a national meeting. So we're learning new things every day about hemp. Don't expect that I'm an expert in hemp. But I want to point out, I'm going to present data from our 2017 and 2018 trials that were largely managed by our technicians, Jamie Crawford and Julie Hansen and Rebecca Wilk. And it's only in the last 10 months or so that I've been able to add two fantastic graduate students, Jacob Toth and George Stack, and I'll present some of Jacob's data, and postdoc Craig Carlson. As Carl mentioned, I'm located at Cornell Agritech in Geneva, and Chris and Alan are also located there, but we collaborate this work. I'll present data from Don Vines and Josh Rose's lab on the Ithaca campus. So it's critical to present this slide at the beginning of any talk about hemp because there has been a fundamental misunderstanding of hemp for decades and association with marijuana, which led to its prohibition. So botanically, there's relatively little difference. Genetically, we can resolve the differences through whole genome markers. But that's largely been through the work of breeders of cannabis sativa. The fundamental difference between hemp and marijuana, it's a legal one, is the concentration of THC. If it produces greater than 0.3% delta-9 THC, then it's marijuana. If it produces less than that, it's hemp. So breeders have bred hemp to produce yields of grain or fiber, or more recently, cannabidiol, CBD. We'll be talking a lot about that. Whereas other breeders have been breeding cannabis sativa to produce high amounts of THC. And I'm not going to be talking about that. The legal difference is important because hemp is now legal after the 2018 Farm Bill. It has been taken off of the DEA controlled substance list, whereas obviously marijuana is still a Schedule I controlled substance and is federally illegal. We've grown a lot of hemp in this country, and these are interesting data from the USDA, and I want to highlight, it's a little bit difficult to understand this table because the different years come from different states, but essentially look at 1942 and 43. When we were growing hemp to support the war effort, fiber hemp, for rope primarily. And if you look at the numbers, it's primarily coming from Wisconsin, Kentucky, Illinois, Minnesota, Iowa, and Indiana, with that, and Tennessee, with that peak in 1942 and 43. So somewhere around 180 to 200,000 acres of hemp. And you'll see in a slide coming up that we're probably going to exceed those numbers this year. Most of that was for fiber. There was a little bit for grain at that time, and again, the grain numbers were localized only to Kentucky and Tennessee. So it's interesting that we do have this historic context for producing hemp in the United States, but after the Controlled Substance Act, it was prohibited. So we're working in a context now of trying to sort out what is rumor and what is fact. That is one of the biggest challenges as we try to assemble a comprehensive hemp research program. We have very little basis for or foundation of scientific literature to work from, and there's really very little. There was really very little research that was going on at that time. It was just a very rapid scale up of production and then a rapid decline immediately after the war. The interesting thing, and what I think politicians found attractive, was there was a market for hemp products in the United States, and in 2017 it was estimated to be about $820 million for a wide diversity of products. And you'll hear that hype about hemp, that you can produce 25,000 products from it. The real question is which of those products are competitive in the marketplace right now and are really better than what we're using already. I'll just highlight a couple. On the right, this picture on the right here is of a non-woven insulation made from hemp by Sunstrand in Louisville, Kentucky. And that is potentially a replacement for fiberglass. There are a number of food products that we can make from hemp. Obviously, we can make textiles, and Patagonia has a nice line of products made from fiber hemp. But really, the big market attraction right now is for cannabidiol, CBD, estimated in 2017 to have a market valued at $190 million. If we do back-of-the-envelope calculations based on acreage that we know and the value of hemp right now, I would guess it's already a multi-billion dollar market this year, and some of the market firms have estimated it will be $22 billion by 2022. So we'll talk about that gold rush and why it has been so attractive, but this is the main driver right now, is cannabidiol, which people are using largely based on recommendations, word of mouth recommendations, rather than prescriptions from their doctors. So it is a social media driven market of people who are getting benefits for chronic pain, perhaps to help them sleep. It is a proven medicine for the treatment of childhood epilepsy, and it has been shown through clinical trials to reduce seizures in children with those diseases from as many as 20 to 25 seizures a day to zero or one seizure per day. So that has been demonstrated, and cannabidiol is now available in prescription form as the drug Epidiolex. But what you're finding in the supermarkets are generally hemp extracts that contain cannabidiol and perhaps other cannabinoids with low THC. So going from 1942 or 1943, when we had 180 or 200,000 acres of hemp in cultivation, this is the current state of hemp cultivation based on the 2014 Farm Bill. We're still working under those guidelines until the USDA works out a national framework based on the 2018 Farm Bill. Based on the 2014 Farm Bill language, each state had to pass their own state pilot program through the Department of Agriculture and legislature in that state. And right now we have 45 states who have enacted those programs. You really want to be looking at the states with the check marks because those are the states that are actually growing hemp. All of the tan states are very recently enacted. And the ones with the orange check marks are the ones that had active cultivation in 2017. The five states with the green check marks are more recently added. But really the leaders are Kentucky, Oregon, Colorado, North Carolina, and I'll include New York in that as well. So the other remarkable thing is that nationally we have tripled the acreage of hemp production each year over the last 3 years. And that's my estimate for 2019 that will total somewhere around 250 to 300,000 acres of cultivation. In New York, I think we'll have somewhere around 8,000 acres in cultivation. So it has been a remarkably fast scale-up and adoption of this crop by growers. And we as researchers and extension educators are pedaling fast and taking in information through a fire hose to try to keep up with the grower demand. So hemp is a cannabis sativa is a very interesting plant. It's an interesting crop. Carl mentioned I also work on willow bioenergy crops, which are dioecious. Hemp is dioecious. It has male and female plants. And sex is controlled by an XY sex chromosome system. So many of the grain and fiber crops are dioecious crops. They will be 50% male in the field. And you can see in the photo on the left, the male plants tend to grow a little bit taller, flower and then senesce a little bit earlier after having pollinated the female plants, which are setting seed in this field. There are also variants of the X chromosome that result in Monishi or a bisexual plant that's producing both male and female flowers. Hermaphrodite, perhaps, is a better term. And that's mainly for dual-purpose grain and fiber production. But again, most of the growers are producing for CBD. And in that case, they hope to maintain an exclusively female production field because the CBD is produced in trichomes of those floral tissues. And when the female flowers are pollinated, the levels of CBD and THC tend to go down 2 to 3-fold. Now, I will say we have a fairly poor understanding of that mechanism, of why the levels decline, whether it's simply a reallocation of resources. It could just be the way that we're measuring, and that when you add seed weight to that dry biomass, the seeds have no CBD, so you're diluting out the CBD concentration. But we do have evidence that upon pollination, the levels of CBD do go down in those floral tissues. So we've been playing tricks on the flowering system of hemp to produce seed lots that are exclusively female. So by treating a female plant, which is XX, with silver thiosulfate, you can induce male flower parts. You can induce pollen on those plants. You can collect that pollen and do a hybrid cross to another female, or you can self it. But all of the seed that's produced from those only have X chromosomes. So we call that feminized seed, and that has been very popular among CBD growers. So popular that the price of feminized seed this spring was $1 per seed. So at 26,000 seeds per pound, those producers were getting about $25,000, $26,000 per pound of feminized seed. So again, another example of a gold rush. If you had a good cultivar and the ability to generate those feminized seed, I think you did pretty well this spring. If you have male plants in your seed lot, you could be in trouble because you don't want your female field to be pollinated. That lowers your CBD levels. So we have developed, well, in the literature, there are pretty good examples of why specific sequences. And my student Jacob Toth took some of those sequences and developed PACE assays, a modified CASP assay, for the Y-specific regions, and we now have pretty reliable markers to identify males and females. So here's an example of that from two different populations, which were clearly segregating 50-50 for males and females. So some growers are using those genetic tests to identify males in their populations and to characterize the percentage of males in a what should have been a feminized seed lot that they purchased. There are a number of companies that are offering that genetic test on the market. But we find it useful in our breeding program rather than sending out people to go out and cull males out of the field. So that's a little bit of background. My title was Building a Comprehensive Research Program Around Hemp. And Chris Smart, who's the director of the School of Integrative Plant Science, has assembled a comprehensive multidisciplinary team at Cornell, largely within the School of Integrative Plant Science, but also including some entomologists. Now we've also added two folks in our Dyson School working on crop insurance and on co-ops for hemp production. And we also have a colleague in our food science department who is working on extraction and protein food products from hemp. But you see there are a number of horticulturalists here, Neil Mattson and Bill Miller working on greenhouse production and flowering. Again, I'll present a lot of data from Joss Rose's lab on biochemistry. And I don't have time to talk about the great work that Chris and Gary Bergstrom are doing characterizing diseases and helping us to identify potential resistance genes in segregating populations. Particularly, we're seeing that now for powdery mildew. So that's really interesting. Again, Alan Taylor is here in the third row and has done a lot of work on seed science. That's one of the barriers is there is really no certified seed for CBD hemp available on the market. And some of the quality of the seed that's being sold is very poor, according to Alan's characterization. At the bottom of that list, Matthew Willman has been working on tissue culture and transformation. Hemp is very challenging in tissue culture. He has had difficulty getting regeneration to work at this point, but we're going to plug away at it and continue to hopefully get some breakthroughs so that we can start to do some functional genomics and CRISPR modification as we identify genes of interest. We've also built a pretty comprehensive extension network across the state that was initially focused on field crops, but again, with the rise of the CBD cultivation, we're finding that our specialty crop extension educators are maybe a little bit better suited to advising growers. It is largely our vegetable growers that are making that shift because of the cultivation system for CBD in raised beds under plastic with irrigation. Interestingly, in Kentucky and North Carolina, it's the tobacco growers that are making that shift. So they have, again, the cultivation practices and the equipment that are particularly well-suited. While, you know, probably naively when we got into this, we thought it was going to be grown as a field crop for grain and fiber. So overall, our program goals are first, to initiate what's available commercially. I'll use air quotes in describing them as cultivars. You'll see that we're seeing that particularly this year that some of the lines that we have been given to test are clearly segregating in the field. They are not true breeding cultivars yet. But we want to be able to advise growers as to which cultivars they should be planting. Again, our pathologists and entomologists and horticulturalists are working on crop management, and we have folks in cooperative extension working on the economics of the system. We need to do a lot of work on fertility recommendations, and we've just recruited Steve Reiners and Corinne Ketterings to work on starting to build fertility recommendations. But my main interest is in breeding. So we want to look at the available germplasm and figure out how to make crosses properly, how to control flowering, and characterize the diversity of what we have available to us so that we can, within a few years, develop some new cultivars, in our case, adapted to the New York climate. So pretty much the rest of my talk is going to be focused on how we can establish a long-term hemp breeding program. And I'm going to try to frame what we've done in this context. What is our available germplasm? What can we do to characterize that? What are the barriers to assembling germplasm? We want to start to phenotype. And again, we're in our third year now of evaluating commercial cultivars for grain, fiber, and dual-purpose production. We're in our second year phenotyping for CBD production, and I'll talk about the risk of also producing THC at the same time. That is a major risk. Based on these early trials, we've modeled the cost of production, and that can highlight why there is a gold rush, has been a gold rush to CBD production. And then finally, I'm going to talk about some of the markers that we've been able to develop that will help us guide a breeding strategy over the long term. So, what is available to us as breeders in terms of hemp germplasm? I'm sure for many of the crops that you work on, you can go to the GRIN database and look up some of the characteristics that Ben Gutierrez may have found in the National Grape Germplasm Collection in Geneva, for example, and order that, and the folks will go out and collect some cuttings for you that you can use to establish your breeding program. Well, if you search for cannabis, you see that there are 150 accessions. So we did have a germplasm collection maintained by the ARS, but it says, if you can read it there, zero active, zero available. So that collection was destroyed when hemp was put on the Schedule I controlled substance list. So we don't have that resource that ARS very professionally maintains and characterizes for us, for all of our other crops, but I think that may change in the very near future. You might also think about collecting from wild accessions and hoping for natural diversity that has evolved through adaptation to different environments and different latitudes. So we can, again, look at the plants.usda.gov map at a county level, or I use this EDD map because in some states, marijuana is considered a noxious weed in Missouri, Illinois, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Interestingly, in Minnesota, hemp is a noxious weed. I'm not sure if that's interfering with their cultivation of hemp as a crop these days. Again, here's a legal distinction between marijuana and hemp on a noxious weed list. So here is a map of where you can find largely escaped populations. So it is a little bit tricky, this map. It's probably a melding of escaped marijuana and escaped hemp. But you see in those central states in the Corn Belt, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, there is a lot of what they call ditch weed. And that is a resource that we hope to tap into through a USDA Hatch multi-state project. One of our tasks will be for cooperators in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Kansas, Illinois to go out and collect natural populations of feral hemp or ditch weed that we can start to build to do association genetics and to look for alleles of traits of interest, such as disease resistance, flowering time, protein concentration in seed. You might think about going to the areas of origin, where the wild populations are. And I think there is pretty good agreement that hemp arose in Central Asia, in the stands in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan. So there are wild populations in those areas. The issue there is that I think there's general agreement that all of those plants are producing greater than 0.3% THC. So that is a barrier to collecting that material. It's illegal in those regions, and there will be some barriers. We're having barriers now, discussions with our general counsel at Cornell about whether we can even handle feral hemp here in the United States, much less feral hemp collected from Kazakhstan. There is some arrows largely demonstrating the flow of hemp from its site of origin in 2000 BC to the Middle East, to India, to other regions of Asia, and into Eastern Europe. I think some of these dates I would take with a grain of salt, but because it was moved into North America during colonial times for the production of rope and sailcloth for the British Navy. So I think that 1920 AD in North America is probably a little too late. So my graduate students tell me you can find videos on YouTube of folks who have traveled through those regions and made collections, probably without the permission of the local authorities. We would hope that at some point we can gain access to wild populations and that the wealth of alleles that are represented in those populations. So the next step is to characterize the genetic diversity of the germplasm that we have available. And Phylos is a biotech company that is doing a very good job of that. Their original business plan was to use whole genome markers. They were using amplicon sequencing initially and now have moved on to a chip array to characterize and fingerprint genotypes that growers have. And if you look at this figure, you can see on the right, the green dots largely represent landrace accessions of hemp. Which are genetically distinct from populations on the left, which are largely marijuana or hybrids of marijuana and hemp, which are being used for CBD production. So this is a 3D PCA representation, and we do see quite a bit of diversity. The issue that Phylos is having as well in their business plan is that they don't have good phenotypic characterization of these samples, or reliable names, or pedigrees. So what we hope to do again is to start to do some association genetics by matching genotype with phenotype. That's something that Phylos is lacking in this database at this point. So we have done some initial genotyping of material that we've had access to. Material, commercial cultivars of grain and fiber types and CBD types that we've tested in our trials, as well as samples collected from 14 farms across New York State. And what we see is in green, again, we can see a clade of grain and fiber type, industrial hemp type that tend to group together. Although it's interesting that, there are some CBD types that do group in with the industrial hemp types, so perhaps have been backcrossed, have been crossed with marijuana and then backcrossed to have a largely hemp genetic background. There is my arrow. Here is an interesting group of Chinese fiber types that are grouping together. A lot of CBD hemp with the name cherry tends to group together. So we do see some pedigree relatedness here. These are all cultivars from a hemp company in Oregon called Oregon CBD, so those are all grouping together. So our conclusion just from one plate of GBS is that there are going to be distinct groups of genetically related CBD cultivars based on their pedigree, that industrial hemp tends to be quite distinct from those CBD cultivars, but also that the names that we're seeing, which I know you can't read here, largely don't always reflect the genotype that we're detecting by GBS. We just sent in another plate of 95 samples, so we'll be able to double this analysis here and match genotypes with the phenotypes of what we're growing in the field this year, so we can start to see, oh yeah, that grouping of Oregon CBD, they have a particular cannabinoid profile or terpene profile. Those Chinese hemp types have a particular growth form and flowering time. And that's what is going to be valuable as we choose parents for future crosses. So the next phase is to talk about phenotyping. Phenotyping / cultivar evaluation. I'm going to talk about the grain and fiber trials that we've done. So in order to evaluate a large number of cultivars in relatively small space in a quick amount of time, we've used small plot trials, 4-foot by 20-foot plots planted with a 6-row cone seeder with replicate plots on each site. We plant 15 live seed per square foot for grain and dual purpose types. We plant at double that planting density for fiber types. You want to have a nice tight stand so that those plants grow tall and thin with no branching. So we're aiming for 30 live seed per square foot. And then for grain, we have an Almaco small plot combine that we're using to combine for grain. We've been trying to phenotype all the traits we can through the growing season, starting with establishment. And establishment of hemp from seed can be tricky. It is a finicky crop. It does not display strong early seedling vigor. It's very sensitive to compaction and to flooding. So if you plant hemp and then you have a heavy rain that will cause crusting over, the seedlings won't break through that crust. And it's pretty susceptible to pythium. So the other aspect is that we don't have any registered herbicides. So if you don't get good stand establishment, then it's probably going to be overtaken by weeds because growers don't have any management tools in terms of herbicides at this point. Flowering date is very interesting. It has been challenging for us as we put 30 cultivars in randomized trials when one cultivar is ready to harvest in late August and other cultivars aren't mature until mid to late September. It is a logistical challenge for us because we want to drive that combine through that trial and harvest everything at one time and then move the combine on to the next field site. So I will say that some of our early data is probably compromised by lower yields of varieties that matured earlier and then started to shatter and were predated by birds. Birds love hemp seed. Versus higher yields of cultivars that we waited until they were right at the proper maturity date so they didn't shatter and didn't get predated by birds. That has become a real challenge. Our pathologists and entomologists have been surveying for pests and diseases. Unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about that, but we'll just summarize. Sclerotinia is a big issue. Botrytis is a big issue in the flower heads. European corn borer has been an issue. Other than European corn borer, we really haven't seen too many other insect pests. And then pythium during establishment. So we've been measuring dry, clean grain yield, harvested with a small plot combine, and then cleaned. And for fiber, I'll show you we've last year started to do redding so that we can report redded straw yield. So over the last 2 years, we've had an ambitious plan to test cultivars on a number of sites. In 2017, we had 17 cultivars trialed across five sites, three in Ithaca, two in Geneva. And we also received a grant from New York State to try to recruit growers to grow hemp. This was a $900,000 grant. We used that to purchase 51,000 pounds of hemp seed from Ontario, Canada, and then distributed that to 24 farms that were recruited and licensed through New York State Ag and Markets, totaling 1,700 acres. Now, we got that grant, I think, on June 10th, and got the first load of seed on July 10th. So very little of that 1,700 acres actually reached harvested maturity. But we did get a lot of growers interested in hemp and learned a bit about how to get it established in mid to late July. It did put New York up on the top of the list in terms of total acreage grown. In 2018, we doubled our number of cultivars to 35 grain and fiber cultivars and ambitiously planted those on six sites, including our Horticultural Research and Extension Center in Riverhead on Long Island, all the way up to our Dairy Research Institute in Chazy, up near the Canadian border, as well as two sites in Ithaca and two sites in Geneva. Now, the Chazy site had an Almaco combine, so they were able to harvest most of their plots, but in the end, we never figured out the logistics to get our Almaco combine through New York City and out to the Long Island site. So we did a little bit of harvesting by hand, but I could not convince my technicians to drive that gooseneck trailer with the 13-foot tall combine on the back down past Macy's. We also tested 15 CBD cultivars on two sites, and I'm going to present a lot of data on that here in the next few slides. So just to summarize what we've learned over 2 years of grain and fiber trials, if you get it established, that hemp by 7 weeks grows very tall and vigorous. It will shade out the weeds if you get it established well enough, and it gets the proper moisture regime during those first 7 weeks. Here's a picture of our combine. We have to generally raise the header as high as we can. Some of the Canadian cultivars have been bred for short stature, and they're much easier to combine. They don't produce any fiber straw at all. But the dual-purpose cultivars that have been bred in Europe can be 6 or 7 or even 8 feet tall at the end of the season, and you're running a lot of green matter through that combine. It's pretty hard on the combine there. We have gotten, in 2017, we got pretty impressive yields of grain, so the top cultivar across five sites, and a couple of these sites were very marginal. Average 1,400 pounds to the acre. Our top cultivar in our top trial was 2,400 pounds to the acre of dry, clean grain. That's in comparison to the average yields in Canada, which is the largest producer of hemp grain, of about 800 to 900 pounds per acre. So we can produce impressive yields of grain with dedicated cultivars, and we're starting to get a pretty good idea of which of those European cultivars you see, Felina 32, Bialy Brzeski, and Anka, and Futura 75, I would suggest those are all solid cultivars to grow in New York State. And here's the attractive thing about the grain. It has a high amount of oil, so 35-36% oil, with a very healthy mix, an optimal mix of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. That 3-to-1 ratio, I'm told, is ideal and makes it a good replacement for fish oil. So if we're switching from meat-based to plant-based diets, there are a lot of impressive properties about hemp grain in that potential market, including the oil as a good culinary oil. It has a low smoking temperature, so it's not a good cooking oil, but it's very good for your pesto or your salad dressing. And it has a good nutty flavor. And then after you've pressed the grain for oil, you're left with about a 50% press cake, 26 to 27% in the whole grain, about 50% protein content in the press cake. So there are companies, again, that are tapping into the growing market for plant-based proteins. whether it's for plant-based meats or for smoothies for athletes or high-protein bars for old people like me. I think hemp, again, can tap into that market because it does have an impressive production of protein in the grain. What we're hoping in the industry is to complete the feeding trials to be able to use that press cake as an animal feed. So the beef producers in Colorado have gathered together the money to do the feeding trials to get it on the generally recognized as safe list as an additive for beef. Next, they will move on to getting it approved for pet foods. So again, think about, again, the natural ingredients market for dog food these days, and I think hemp can really contribute to that once we have it on the generally recognized as safe list. It's a very good feed for poultry and improves the quality of eggs. So I think once we get through all of that testing and regulatory approval, it will open up some impressive markets for the hemp grain. Moving on to fiber, we tend to harvest the fiber hemp a little bit earlier, right at the start of flowering. So here's a picture from 2017 on August 21st, when the average height was about 8 feet. Some of those plants are 10 to 12 feet tall. And we're harvesting with a sickle bar mower, laying the stems on the field to ret. That is a process of microbial degradation, allowing the separation of the high-quality long fibers in the bast from the woody core, which we call the herd. And that retted fiber, once it's baled and sent to a processing facility, would be decorticated, again, to separate the high-quality fibers from the herd. The fibers could go into technical applications, biomaterials, or fabric, textiles, rope, while the herd, people are using, you've probably heard of hempcrete. So the herd would be mixed with lime to make hempcrete, or it can go for animal bedding or other applications as a bio-based absorbent, for example. So again, we're getting pretty impressive yields of retted straw. You see our top site averaged 4.5 dry tons of retted straw per acre. And I think that, again, would be competitive with production in China, which is the largest producer of hemp fiber in the world. We've also last year planted on a larger scale, on the order of 2 to 3 acres, some cultivars to demonstrate combine harvesting. Again, that is a challenge and has been a deterrent to growers getting involved in hemp because you're talking about driving your combine through material that's used to make rope, right? So it will bind up on any rotating parts, on the shafts, and it will get into the bearings. So you do need to modify and protect your combine and have a fire extinguisher handy. But as we saw here, this was a totally unmodified combine from a local grower who came through and harvested, again, pretty impressive yields, about 1,300 pounds per acre of Anca, which should be competitive on the marketplace. Okay, so our takeaways from all of those trials, we're starting to sort out which cultivars are well adapted for New York environment and conditions, that hemp is a nutrient-demanding crop. We are fertilizing it with 150 pounds per acre of nitrogen to get those yields, and it requires our best farmland in New York State. It does not like poorly drained land, does not tolerate flooding. It likes a rich silt loam soil, but if you put it on that soil, it will produce good yields. So moving on to CBD production, on the left is an example of a commercial farm in Orange County, New York. That was a clone that was planted, so you see it's very nice and uniform. That is not the case for a lot of the seeded crops that are being sold these days. We established our plants in the greenhouse and knew that we had a mix of males and females, so we let them go pretty long in the greenhouse, hoping they would flower and we could cull out the males before we planted. That's why they're so tall at the time of planting. This year we avoided all that by using the genetic test so that we can plant them at the proper time when they're only 4 or 5 inches tall. But you see, again, labor-intensive planting into raised beds with plastic and trickle irrigation. Chichi Magli apparently has sold a lot of transplanters to hemp growers who are using that cultivation method. I will say, I need to highlight this, that in 2018, the varieties that we were testing were largely intermediates in the breeding programs of two hemp breeders, one based here in Las Vegas and the other based in Oregon. And they are both historically marijuana breeders, and we'll see that in the data that we've derived from those. So we did not have a good broad representation of the commercial cultivars in our 2018 trials, and there were some issues with this material that we tested. This year, I'll show you, we have 30 cultivars that I think are a pretty good representation of what's commercially available and a broad diversity of the genetics that's out there. So in the middle of August, actually on the day of our field day, we got 3.5 inches of rain in Geneva. And that resulted in flooding of one of our CBD fields, and there was standing water in the field for a good week, and the plants just crashed. So again, one thing we learned, you've got to put it on your best well-drained soil. If you have any standing water, those plants won't tolerate it. And also because the field was so wet, we had intended to fertilize through our trickle irrigation, and we weren't able to do that. So the picture on the left is a plant that has become pretty severely nitrogen starved by the end of the season. And I'm sure that impacted our CBD yields. On the left is a picture of how the regulatory sampling would be done. They pick the top of the shoot, where the CBD and THC concentrations will be highest, and sample from a few plants from a field. But we did a combination of sampling, generating a composite sample of 10 plants per plot for our grain and fiber trials, and sampling individual plants for our CBD trials. The current commercial practice is to harvest whole plants and to dry them, for example, in Kentucky and North Carolina in a tobacco drying barn, or in New York, they might dry it in a pole barn. Some people using dehydration, dehumidification, and hopefully a lot of air movement so they don't get mold growth on those whole plants. And then we would strip the floral material off by hand, and a lot of growers were doing that by hand. There is some machinery now that's being adapted to be able to run stems through and strip off the material off the stems, but a lot of growers are still doing it by hand. So as you tally it all up, the cost of the seed and the transplants, the cost of the raised beds and the irrigation, the fact that you have to do hand weed management because there's no herbicides, hand harvesting, drying, and stripping, there is a lot of hand labor involved in the production. Okay, so here are our yield data for CBD, which help us get to the economics. We had significant differences in dried floral biomass yield between our Ithaca and Geneva trials, so Ithaca in the gray bars and Geneva in the light blue bars. We averaged about 0.9 pounds per plant. A good rule of thumb, commercial average, is about a pound per plant. If you're a good producer with good conditions, you might get up to 2 pounds per plant. Our Geneva trial clearly was underperforming, with our highest yields only about 0.5 pounds per plant. Next, we need to characterize the CBD content. So just to show you the cannabinoid biosynthetic pathway, it starts with a single precursor, CBGA, and then there are three competing enzymes. They are evolutionarily related. One that will lead to the production of THC, one to CBD, and the third to CBC. So there are competing enzymes for a common precursor. In marijuana, there is no active CBDA synthase. So marijuana, in that pathway in marijuana, is entirely directed to THC synthesis. In hemp, there should not be an active THCA synthase. So that pathway should be directed entirely, pretty much entirely, to CBD synthesis. And CBC is a minor component. We'll see that. So clearly the CBDA synthase enzyme is generally winning out or has higher expression than the CBCA synthase enzyme. The other important thing to note from this figure is that the form that's produced in the plant is the acidic form, which is converted to the basic form generally thermally through smoking, as it's shown in this picture. It's important because of the regulatory testing. In New York State last year, the regulators only considered the final form, the Delta-9 THC, in their tests, and they were using an HPLC method that could resolve the two different forms and did not thermally convert the THCA to THC. Now, with the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill, the language is pretty clear that it should be the total potential THC after decarboxylation. So you'll see that becomes a major issue if you combine the total production of THCA and potential THC in these cultivars. So we did all of our biochemistry together with Joss Rose, and his postdoc Glenn Philippe did all of this analysis last year, about 1,200 samples by HPLC. So here is our CBD analysis. Our top cultivars were producing 8 to 9%. The industry standard is about 10%, 10 to 12%. And our averages, even though the yields were lower of biomass in Geneva, our CBD percentages were not significantly different. So again, we've been able to identify some pretty good cultivars here that we have the ability to breed with that we are now using in crosses to develop new cultivars like A2R4, RNF, and Wild Horse. So that now gives us the ability to calculate some of the economics and to talk about the gold rush here. It's not for grain and fiber. If we get a 1,000-pound yield of grain that's priced at about $1.10 per pound, you know, we're getting $1,100 per acre. If we get 4 tons of red and straw at 10 cents a pound, again, 800 pounds per acre, that's probably comparable or competitive with our current grain crops. But when you look at CBD hemp, it's been priced at a dollar per point or percentage of CBD per pound. So last year, the market was supporting $4 per percent CBD per pound. So if you produced a 10% CBD crop, you were getting $40 per pound of dried flower material at farm gate. Planting at about 1,400 plants per acre, 1,400-pound yield per acre was a pretty good yield for the better growers, times 40 pounds per acre, 56,000 pounds gross per acre. So if you controlled your costs and you kept them under $20,000 per acre in terms of seed cost and mulch and irrigation and drying facilities and labor, you probably got a pretty good return. But we've now tripled our acreage again this year, and the prices at the start of the season were down to $2 per point. And in some places you hear that the price is down to $1 per point. So there was a gold rush, and now maybe we're headed to a crash. The other issue is the risk to the growers. So now there's a financial risk in terms of the price of CBD, but there's also a risk of THC. So I'm going to show you some graphs now which show the ratio of CBD to THC. And that dotted line is drawn at the 0.3% Delta-9 level. And you see that some of these varieties that I got from the breeder here in Las Vegas went hot even for Delta-9 THC. When you add the total max potential THC, nearly all of them went hot. So in the 2018 Farm Bill, by changing that standard, it's going to put a lot of growers at risk. But again, remember that these were not final cultivars that I was testing. We do have the ability to test for the presence of active THC and CBDA synthase genes, and They are linked together on the genome. There is an indel in the CBDA synthase gene, which makes it inactive, that is linked to the functional THCA gene. So you either inherit a active THCA and non-active CBDA synthase, or you inherit an active CBDA synthase and a non-functional THCA synthase. So my student Jacob Toth has developed PACE markers, high throughput markers that we can use, and you can see in these two populations, when we screened 95 plants, the vast majority were homozygous for the active THCA synthase type. A few were heterozygous, the gray dots in the middle, and a very small number were homozygous for the hemp type. But we can now use those markers to sort out the plants that we want to use in crosses. He's now taken the entire 215 plants we had in those in one of those trials, in the Geneva trial, and compared the genotype of the individual plants, and you'll see with the CBDA and THCA content, you can see that all of those populations were segregating except for the commercial dual-purpose Futura 75. That was entirely hemp type, but every other entry that we had in that trial still had some functional THCA synthase genes in the population. We can now use these markers to segregate those out very quickly. And there's a very good correlation between those markers and the total potential THC or CBD. You see the two that are homozygous marijuana type, the red dots, produced 6 to 7% total potential THC. The blue dots in the bottom are homozygous hemp type, producing a range of CBD content. The concerning thing here is that the trend of that line is going up for THC. So that gives us pause that perhaps the CBDA synthase enzyme can also make a little bit of THC, because there is not probably a functional THCA synthase gene in those plants. And it's all about the ratio. The highest ratio we can probably get is 30-1 CBD to THC. In marijuana, they essentially don't make any CBD. So more than 40-1 CBD to THC to CBD. So a final point about that 0.3 threshold. On the right is the line for simply the delta 9 THC quantification. You see that all of the hemp type fall below that delta 9 threshold. If you consider the total potential THC, though, you see there's some risk there, that a lot of the homozygous hemp-type plants are still going to produce above that 0.3% threshold. If it were 1% total THC, I think our growers could be assured of staying compliant. So our outcomes and takeaways, we're doing more work on the genetics of the biosynthetic pathway. We're looking at stress responses this year and have a trial focused on applying stress. We're starting to look more at flowering and pick apart the mechanisms of sex determination. But our long-term goal is to breed for a cultivar that can be mechanically planted and mechanically harvested. And I'll show you one final picture here. So we've got 30 cultivars from across the country in our trials on two different sites. We've got three cultivars in a trial intended to apply stress treatments, and we've got some demo trials in Long Island and the Hudson Valley where there's a lot of interest in CBD hemp. We do see some variation in the minor cannabinoids, but that will be a target for future breeding, as will increasing trichome density and improving total cannabinoid production. But our point here, and let's see if I can get the pointer to work, is we hope to produce a cultivar similar to this one that produced an impressive yield of grain, but also 3 to 4% CBD. So that will be our target, is something like this that can be harvested with a conventional combine system to harvest 800 to 900 pounds of grain per acre, but also perhaps 1,000 pounds of floral material at 4% CBD. So I think that's where the future is headed in CBD hemp. So hopefully, I'm sorry, maybe we have time for a few questions, but if we don't, catch up to me after the talk. I need to thank all of our funding has come from New York State through New York State Ag and Markets or Empire State Development Corporation, thanks to the very strong support we have from Governor Cuomo and the legislature. Follow me on Twitter at Cornell Willow, and you can get a lot of these data from our website, hemp.cals.cornell.edu. So thanks very much for your attention. Yeah, so the question is, what is the state of genetic modification, either through conventional or through CRISPR genome editing? So there are some companies that are reporting a THCA synthase knockout gene on their website, but I don't think those have made it to the marketplace yet. I don't think there are reports of CRISPR modification. There may have just been a paper that's come out talking about transformation of hemp, but there's very little data in the peer-reviewed published literature about successful transformation, and I don't think there's a report of CRISPR modification yet. That doesn't mean that companies have not accomplished that in their own R&D labs.
Hi there. Sorry. I know you bring up the 1% hopeful total potential in-field testing standardization, which would be ideal. I'd love to see a 1, 2, or 3% statewide because I think it still wouldn't kill anybody. Are there any states that are currently promoting that legislation where we can maybe have the Department of Agriculture adapt that level of a 1% and above? I know here in the state of Nevada, we just went to a homogenized test that includes stalk and stem as well as the top 6 inches of the plant, but still seeing formalized testing as the results are coming in this season, I don't think it's really adjusting us to a place where we're really more so trying to regulate the plant where we should be in the finished product on the shelf versus in the field.
So there are a couple of developments. So one development is that the attorney for the USDA has interpreted the language of the 2018 Farm Bill to say that if the original plant tested below 0.3% THC, then all of the THC derived from that plant is not considered to be on the Schedule 1 list. So if your original plants were compliant and through the processing of those plants, at some point you achieve a concentration of THC, that THC is not considered to be on the Schedule 1 controlled substance list. So I've heard it described as good THC from hemp versus bad THC from marijuana. There are states that are passing guidelines. I heard that Florida passed a 0.7% threshold. The issue with that is that all that hemp is now confined within state lines because you can't legally drive it across state lines. It's federally marijuana. So that's the issue, is without federal legislation, states can pass their own guidelines. Growers would be at the risk of federal law enforcement then, potentially, or, you know, complications with banking or insurance. But states are taking those initiatives.
Thank you.
Hopefully that answered your question. There is still a gray area here, and we haven't even talked about the gray area around including CBD in food and drink products.
We are over our time now. Again, I would say that people want to know what you want to do. I'm fine with it.
I'm fine with it.
Summarize and last slide that we can use it for dual purpose, but at this point, how do you see the potential of withdrawal?
If you're going to ask questions...
I'll repeat the question.
So how do you see the potential of withdrawal as a TV? Because the price of CBD has decreased significantly. So how do you see the potential of withdrawal as a microcrop or CBD? Until now, because we don't have those dual purposes cultivars, and we still have to develop first either fiber or CBD and maybe together and later.
So the question is, I had proposed the future of CBD as a dual crop production, both CBD and either grain or fiber. Those cultivars already exist, and one of those pictures was from Lithuania, where they are doing a dual-purpose grain and CBD harvest. So there already are cultivars that will produce 4% CBD even after they have been pollinated and are producing grain. The issue is, can we build the market for the grain and build the market for the fiber to increase that value at the same time that the market for the CBD is dramatically dropping? I think the way to survive is to either have a boutique CBD production or ultimately to gain the revenue from both CBD and either grain or fiber harvest.
So I was assuming that if we are going for CBD, then we just have to harvest the flowers. But for fiber, we have to take the whole plant and we should wait until we get that yield.
Yeah, so the question is about harvesting now. So there are companies that are developing essentially a flower harvesting head that would ride at about 6 or 7 feet and harvest the flower top while preserving the 6 or 7 feet of standing fiber, which you come back through with a sickle bar mower, let that ret, and then bale that fiber. And the advantage of the dual-purpose fiber harvest is that you can harvest early in floral development, and perhaps capture those female flowers before they've been pollinated and still have a high level of CBD. Yeah, so the question is about what pests we're seeing. We are seeing other borers. I'm not sure that our entomologists have identified those other borers yet, but it does seem to be an attractive stem in terms of the diameter that accumulates on those CBD plants. They can be 3 inches at the base at maturity. So one of our growers commented last year, he had the brilliant plan that he would surround his hemp planting with corn so that it would act as a barrier so that people wouldn't come and steal his hemp. Unfortunately, he had a higher incidence of European corn borer in that field that was surrounded by corn. So it is one of the pests that is of concern. Yeah, so the question is, how do you go about acquiring seed? And that's been one of our biggest, if not the biggest barrier to building this program. So initially, we needed to get a DEA registration for Schedule 1 to be able to import seed into the U.S. Fortunately, that barrier no longer exists. After the 2018 Farm Bill, it's off the Schedule 1 list, so we no longer really need that DEA registration to handle the seed. And again, in the early days, they wanted police escorts of the vehicle out to the field, and they were watching that you vacuumed up every last spilled bit of grain because that was all Schedule 1, like heroin, like you were spilling heroin on the field if you let the seed fall. And then once it's germinated, they didn't care because it was only the seed that was on the Schedule 1 list. The plant actually... The DEA didn't care about. The issue right now is that because there is no, has been no mechanism for intellectual property protection, meaning there is no, has been no formal plant variety protection application process because it's managed by the USDA and they were not willing to hold Schedule 1 controlled substance seed for the evaluation of the PVP, then seed companies have been protecting their varieties through material transfer agreements. So most of the seed that we obtain, all from commercial breeding companies, we sign an MTA saying that we can only use that seed that year. We have to destroy anything that we don't use that year. We cannot replant the seed, and we cannot use it for clonal propagation or breeding. So right now, people are trying to protect their intellectual property through material transfer agreement. So then it becomes a matter of building a relationship with these breeding companies, perhaps incentivizing them to share their material with future licensing opportunities. But fundamentally, our university will not give up the intellectual property that we hold and the cultivars that we develop in our breeding program. The other challenge is dealing with the folks who are breeding hemp out there, who many of them are former marijuana breeders. So it's a matter of sorting out who you can trust, I think, and who is a good partner for the university. And when you hear people say a phrase like, yeah, I've got experience growing this plant for the last 15 years, that gives me pause, because hemp was only legal since 2014. Thanks, Carl. Thank you very much.